If you brought your Bibles with you this morning, if you'd like to follow along as we read, I'm going to be reading from 2 Kings chapter 5. And we're going to read the whole chapter. So, if you'd please stand for the reading of God's Word. 2 Kings chapter 5. Now Naaman, captain of the army of the king of Aram, was a great man with his master and highly respected, because by him the Lord had given victory to Aram. The man was also a valiant warrior, but he was a leper. Now the Arameans had gone out in bands and had taken captive a little girl from the land of Israel, and she waited on Naaman's wife. She said to her mistress, "I wish that my master were with the prophet who is in Samaria. Then he would cure him of his leprosy." Naaman went and told his master, saying, "Thus and thus spoke the girl who is from the land of Israel." Then the king of Aram said, "Go now, and I will send a letter to the king of Israel." He departed and took with him 10 talents of silver, 6,000 shekels of gold, and 10 changes of clothes. He brought the letter to the king of Israel, saying, "And now, as this letter comes to you, behold, I have sent Naaman my servant to you, that you may cure him of his leprosy." When the king of Israel read the letter, he tore his clothes and said, "Am I God to kill and to make alive, that this man is sending word to me to cure a man of his leprosy? But consider now and see how he's seeking a quarrel against me." It happened when Elisha, the man of God, heard that the king of Israel had torn his clothes, that he sent word to the king, saying, "Why have you torn your clothes? Now let him come to me, and he shall know that there is a prophet in Israel." So Naaman came with his horses and his chariots and stood at the doorway of the house of Elisha. Elisha sent a messenger to him, saying, "Go and wash in the Jordan 7 times, and your flesh will be restored to you, and you will be clean." But Naaman was furious and went away and said, "Behold, I thought he will surely come out to me and stand and call on the name of the Lord his God and wave his hand over the place and cure the leper. Are not Abana and Pharpar, the rivers of Damascus, better than all the waters of Israel? Could I not wash in them and be clean?" So he turned and went away in a rage. When his servants came near and spoke to him and said, "My father, had the prophet told you to do something, some great thing, would you not have done it? How much more then when he says, 'Wash and be clean'?" So he went down and dipped himself 7 times in the Jordan, according to the word of the man of God. And his flesh was restored like the flesh of a little child, and he was clean. When he returned to the man of God with all his company and came and stood before him, he said, "Behold, now I know that there is no God in all the earth but in Israel. So please take a present from me for your servant now." But he said, "As the Lord lives, before whom I stand, I will take nothing." And he urged him to take it, but he refused. Naaman said, "If not, please let your servant be given 2 mule loads of earth. Your servant will no longer offer burnt offerings, nor will sacrifice to other gods, but to the Lord. In this matter, may the Lord pardon your servant when my master goes into the house of Rimmon to worship there, and he leans on my hand, and I bow myself in the house of Rimmon. When I bow myself in the house of Rimmon, the Lord pardon your servant in this matter." He said to him, "Go in peace." So he departed from him some distance. But Gehazi, the servant of Elisha, the man of God, thought, "Behold, my master has spared this Naaman, the Aramean, by not receiving from his hands what he brought. As the Lord lives, I will run after him and take something from him." So Gehazi pursued Naaman. When Naaman saw one running after him, he came down from the chariot to meet him and said, Is all well?" He said, "All is well. My master has sent me, saying, 'Behold, just now 2 young men from the sons of the prophets have come to me from the hill country of Ephraim. Please give them 1 talent of silver and 2 changes of clothes.'" Naaman said, "Please take 2 talents. And he urged him and bound 2 talents of silver in 2 bags and 2 changes of clothes and gave them to 2 of his servants, and they carried them before him. When he came to the hill, he took them from their hand and deposited them in the house. And he sent the men away, and they departed. But he went in and stood before his master. And Elisha said to him, "Where have you been, Gehazi?" And he said, "Your servant went nowhere." Then he said to him, "Did not my heart go with you when the man turned from his chariot to meet you. Is it time to receive money and to receive clothes and olive groves and vineyards and sheep and oxen and male and female servants? Therefore, the leprosy of Naaman shall cling to you and to your descendants forever. So he went out from his presence, a leper as white as snow. You may be seated. Let's pray. Father, we do thank you for this morning. We thank you for this opportunity to come. We thank you for your word and for what it can teach us. And I pray this morning that you will give us soft hearts, that we might hear what your word has to teach us. We ask this in Jesus' name. As I continue my series on Elisha, we come to chapter 5, and it's a rather interesting and paradoxical chapter. And I'm going to approach it a little differently. We've talked in the past about the contrast between Elijah and Elisha and how Elijah had kind of a ministry that was more directed to the public and directed at judgment. We talked this morning in Sunday school about Elijah's contest with the 450 prophets of Baal and how God proved to the nation of Israel that he is the one true God by burning up the sacrifice. And subsequent to that, then the 450 prophets of Baal were executed. But in Elisha's case, we see that his ministry was more of a private ministry, a ministry in which he dealt with people one-on-one, and it was more of a ministry of healing. And we see another example of that in this particular chapter as well. But this morning, what I would like to do is take a look at the characters in this story. And if you go through the passage, there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 characters. Seven different people, or in one case, a group of people that are identified that play a part in this story. And we're going to look at them, and we're going to look at not so much the people and what the people did, as much as we are going to look at what God is doing through this whole situation and this whole circumstance. Because even as we begin this passage, we see that it directs us to realize that God is in control. This is a God thing. This is what God is doing. And when we get to the end, hopefully, maybe it'll be a little bit clearer. But it starts out, it says, "Now Naaman, captain of the army of the king of Aram, was a great man and his master, with his master, and highly respected, because by him the Lord had given victory to Aram." So we see right away, the writer here is calling our attention to God's sovereignty. We're introduced to the person Naaman, and he is a military individual. It doesn't really give us a title. It just says that he was highly respected and a great man before the king. And his king is the king of Aram. And I'll give you a little bit of history here just to set the context. Aram was the territory to the north of the nation of Israel. And under King Ahab, Israel had exacted a treaty with Aram. And so there was, to some degree, a peace between the two nations at this particular time. But we notice that God is the one who is attributed to having given Nahum a victory. But Aram is a godless Gentile nation. How does God play into that? I thought God was the God of Israel. And yet, the writer here wants us to understand that, God is not only the God of Israel, but God is the God of the world. And that includes Aram. And that includes the military might of Aram. That includes the king of Aram. So we're introduced to, Nahum, and he's going to be kind of the main thread through this whole story. And in a way, we could say that there's almost two characters, Nahum, and we'll get to that a little bit later. But it says he was a great man with his master and highly respected. So here's a guy that had everything you could possibly want, except for the fact that he wasn't the king. He had prestige. He had honor. He had apparently military brilliance. He was probably extremely wealthy. He was a valiant warrior. But that last little phrase, what does it say? But he was a leper. Big caveat here, huh? You know, he's a great man, but he has a serious skin disease. Now, chances are this is not the same leprosy that we read about in the law, where the leper had to separate themselves and consider themselves unclean. It's not like the lepers probably in the New Testament that Jesus healed that had a very communicable disease. It's probably some other form of a skin disease that was just kind of all lumped into a general category that earlier translations translated it leper, and so that's kind of stuck. It's actually a different word in the Hebrew than true leprosy. But nevertheless, here's a man that had an incurable skin disease. We don't know whether it disfigured him. We don't know whether it, you know, when he put on his armor, did it make him itch uncontrollably? There's obviously something with this disease that was unattractive. He had all that you could want, except he was a leper. Now the Arameans had gone out in bands and taken captive a little girl from the land of Israel, and she waited on Naaman's wife. Okay, we come to the second character. And the interesting thing about this story is those characters whom you think ought to be the most important, have the most impact, be the most prominent, are not necessarily those that do. And the characters who you think are somewhat obscure really are the characters who make the difference in this story. And here's one of them. A little girl from the land of Israel. She says to her mistress, "I wish that my master were with the prophet who is in Samaria, then he would cure him of his leprosy." Imagine for a moment, you're in the land of Israel, and you see a raiding band come raging over the hills, down onto your village, taking what they want, killing, kidnapping, and it's your daughter they just took. Imagine that you're the daughter. And you have been just kidnapped and taken from your family. Everything that you know. You have no idea what they're going to do to you. You end up in the house of this great military man. And you end up waiting. You're a servant to his wife. How do you react to that? Is God sovereign in this whole thing? Why am I here? I hate these Arameans. They do terrible things to people. I wish they would all die so I could go home. What does the little girl do? That apparently is not at all her attitude. Because what does she say to her mistress? I wish my master were with the prophet who is in Samaria. She has compassion on her master who has kidnapped her and carried her away from her family. And yet, in God's sovereign plan for her to be there, she fulfills what God has planned for her. And that is to tell her mistress and her master about an opportunity of healing. How often when we are placed in a circumstance or situation that we're uncomfortable with, do we see the hand of God? You know, we've heard the phrase, bloom where God plants you. But that's not always easy, is it? And I'm sure it wasn't easy for this little girl. I'm sure there were nights she cried herself to sleep wondering where her family was. And yet, today in eternity, I would imagine we will be able to go and find this little girl and the triumph that she is experiencing because she was faithful to her God. We will be astounded. And so I say, the characters who seem like they ought to be the most insignificant are here probably the most, have the most impact in this story. So what happened? Naaman hears about this hope of a cure, and he goes to his master, the king, and saying, thus and thus spoke the girl who is from the land of Israel. So now Naaman has hope that maybe he can be healed. So he takes what he's heard from this little girl, and he goes to the king. And now we're introduced to the third character, the king of Aram. And he says, go now and I will send a letter to the king of Israel. He departed and took with him 10 talents of silver, 6,000 shekels of gold, and 10 changes of clothes. This is the king. We got one little bitty verse for the king of Aram. And all he can do is say, here, I'll send a letter. And oh, by the way, here's some money. Take it with you, you know, as a gift. The man that probably has almost as much power as he has an incurable skin disease, and the king is powerless to do anything about it. And all he can do is write a letter of commendation to the king of a neighboring country and send his general down there. So here's a guy who literally has everything he could possibly want, and yet finds himself powerless to do anything. As significant as this man is, he is totally insignificant in this entire story. Now we come to the fourth character. He brought the letter to the king of Israel saying, now this is a letter. This letter comes to you. Behold, I have sent Naaman my servant to you that you may cure him of his leprosy. When the king of Israel read the letter, he tore his clothes and said, am I God to kill and to make alive, that this man is sending word to me to cure a man of his leprosy? But consider now, see how he is seeking a quarrel against me. The king of Israel gets a letter brought to him by a guy that obviously has an incurable skin disease. And the letter says, cure this guy. Once again, the king of Israel, the highest position in Israel there is. He is the most significant individual in Israel. And yet, what's his response? This guy's trying to start a fight with me. He's trying to get a war between us two. He finds himself also totally unable to do anything about this man's leprosy, and in fact thinks that this is a plot to start a war. He tears his clothes in show of his anguish and mourning and inability to understand and to comprehend what's going on here. And now we come to the fifth character. It happened when Elisha, the man of God, heard the king of Israel had torn his clothes, that he sent word to the king saying, "Why have you torn your clothes? Now let him come to me and he shall know that there is a prophet in Israel." It's not that the king didn't know about Elisha, because the king did know about Elisha. It's just that the king was so consumed with himself and who he was that he couldn't see that there was another solution. And so Elisha, and we don't know how Elisha found out about this. We don't know, you know, maybe Elisha has spies in the palace. I don't know. And so they ran and told Elisha what was going on. Maybe it was just a rumor that spread in the countryside. But we're told that Elisha found out. And so Elisha sent word to the king and said, "You know, you kind of overreacted here. It's not that big a deal. Send the guy down here and we're going to prove again that there is a real God and that he is capable of doing miraculous things and that I am his servant." So once again, we see that this is really not about Naaman. This is not really about the servant girl. This is not about the king of Aram. This is not about the king of Israel. This isn't even about Elisha. But this is about God and about what God is doing in the lives of people. So Naaman came with his horses and his chariots and stood at the doorway of the house of Elisha. Elisha sent a messenger to him saying, "Go and wash in the Jordan 7 times and your flesh will be restored to you and you will be clean." But Naaman was furious and went away and said, "Behold, I thought he will surely come out to me and stand and call on the name of the Lord his God and wave his hand over the place and cure the leper. Are not Abana and Pharpar, the rivers of Damascus, better than all the waters of Israel? Could I not wash in them and be clean?" So he turned and went away in a rage. I want to go back to the character Naaman now. I want to develop his character a little bit here. He was a valiant warrior. He was noble. He was greatly respected in his own country. And as we see him in this situation, we see verified for us his great pride, his arrogance, his attitude toward other people. Because as he pulls up in front of Elisha's house, what does it say? He came with his horses and his chariots. He's not just with one horse and with one chariot. He is with a whole entourage of people that are coming. And if Elijah had looked out his window and had been a fearful type individual, he might have thought that he was about to be executed because of this military-looking entourage that was coming at him. And he came and he stood at the doorway of Elisha. Elisha sent a messenger to him. Elisha didn't even grace Naaman with his presence. He said, "Go tell Naaman that all he needs to do is wash 7 times in the Jordan and he'll be cured." But what's Naaman's response to this? He was furious. And there's 2 reasons he was furious. One, because I am a great man. I am much more worthy of a response in the presence of this prophet and to have him come out and make a big deal over healing this leper. Who does this prophet think he is? Doesn't he know who I am? And then on top of it, he tells me to go and wash in the Jordan River. Do you guys know anything about the Jordan River? Probably not. You know anything about the Wahoo Creek? Well, then you know something about the Jordan River. It's not much bigger than that. And it's not any cleaner than that. It's pretty nasty. It's muddy. The banks are dirt and mud, and it's icky. It's not very deep. I mean, you know, if you're going to go and wash yourself in this, you're going to have to lie down and wallow in the mud. It's just not something that anybody would want to do, much less a guy that is highly respected. And so he asked, are not the rivers of Damascus better than all the waters of Israel? It said that when Muhammad first came to Damascus and he looked on Damascus and the gardens that the rivers in Damascus fed was so beautiful that he refused to enter Damascus because he said you should only enter paradise once. And he refused to ever go into Damascus because apparently Damascus, fed by these beautiful rivers, looked as though it was a garden of paradise. So it makes sense now to me that, I don't really want to go wash in the Jordan River. I might catch more diseases. I'd rather go back home and wash in the clear and the pristine rivers of Damascus. This guy's out of his mind. I'm not doing this. This is way, way beneath me. You know, I know how this ought to be done, and it ain't being done this way. So it ain't going to happen. Naaman is an arrogant, full of himself, unrepentant, leper. And he remains that way because of his arrogance. But the story goes on, and we're introduced to yet another set of characters. Then his servants came near and spoke to him and said, my father, had the prophet told you to do some great thing, would you not have done it? How much more then when he says to you, wash and be clean? Once again, a servant. You know, maybe that's why Jesus told us that if you want to be first, you should be last. If you want to be great, you should be the servant of all. Because in this story, in this account, the people that have the most impact are the people who are relegated to the least. The servants. They have enough insight. They have enough compassion for the people that they interact with to actually make an impact in their life. And so the servants come to Naaman and they go, you've come this far. I know this doesn't seem right. This doesn't look like it's going to work. But you know, if he'd asked you to do some great feat, you would have been more than happy to do it. All he's telling you to do is to humble yourself and wash yourself in the Jordan River. Naaman has a change of heart. So he went down and he dipped himself 7 times in the Jordan, according to the word of the man of God, and his flesh was restored like the flesh of a little child, and he was clean. Once again, I want to point out, it's not Elisha's miracle. Elisha didn't do anything except tell the man what to do. Who performed the miracle here? Who healed Naaman? God did. It was all God. And it's all about God and what God is trying to accomplish in people's lives. And it was not the curing of leprosy that was the great miracle that occurred to Naaman. As we read on, when he returned to the man of God with all his company and came and stood before him, he said, behold, now I know that there is no God in all the earth but in Israel. So please take a present from your servant now. Something happened to Naaman. He long ago realized he had an incurable skin disease. But only when he humbled himself before God did he come to the realization of who he really is before God. This really is a picture of the gospel. Because we see, even in our own lives, our own arrogance and our refusal to do what God prescribes us to do to be cleaned, to be healed, to have the sin taken away. We would rather do some great feat than to apply the blood of Christ to our own sin. What can I do to save myself? That's what we want to know. The same thing that Naaman was trying to do here with his leprosy, we try to do in our own lives with regard to our sin. We want to do it. We want to be able to take credit for it. But God says, no. You have to humble yourself before me. You have to come to the point where you realize you can do absolutely nothing to save yourself. But you must come and you must give up everything that you think is worthy and take what Christ has done on the cross as that which will save you. I had somebody I was talking to yesterday. They asked me what I was reading and I told them. And they said, well, do you think Naaman was converted? And I said, absolutely. I believe I will see Naaman in heaven. And they said, well, why do you say that? Well, as we read on, Naaman is offered presents to Elisha, and Elisha refuses. And he gives a reason. He says, as the Lord lives, before whom I stand, I will take nothing. And he urges him to take it, but he refused. Elisha knows this is not about money. You know, I didn't even do this. God did it. I just told you what to do. I'm not going to take credit for it, and I'm certainly not going to let you pay me for it. Because, you know, you look at it from both sides, then Naaman can kind of say, well, see, I kind of paid for it. And Elisha gets a gain from it. You know, and it can turn into a cycle where, you know, Elisha begins to perform miracles, and that's how he develops his livelihood. And Elisha's not going to go down that path. He refuses to go anywhere near that. So Naaman says, if you're not going to take any of my gifts, then give me something. And he says, please let your servant at least be given 2 mules load of earth, for your servant will no longer offer burnt offerings, nor will he sacrifice to other gods, but to the Lord. So when you guys were converted, when you became Christians, how many of you asked for 2 mules loads of dirt? I didn't. And this doesn't make any sense, does it really? I mean, what do you want a bunch of dirt for, right? Well, let me give you a little explanation. It was believed in that time that gods dwelt within national boundaries. And that god had dominion over that particular area. And so the god in Aram was the god there, and the god of Israel was the god there. And so when you left Israel and went to Aram, then the god of Israel was no longer in control. And so the reason for taking 2 mule loads of dirt back from Israel so that he could still be in Israel. And so God could still be in control of where he was at. Now, you're going, well, that's kind of silly. Well, yeah, it is kind of silly. But where Naaman was at that particular time in his faith and in his walk with God, it made sense. And we can see by His desire to take that dirt and to do with it what He wants to, what He's going to do with it, is an obvious evidence that he has truly been converted. Because he says he will offer no sacrifice to any other gods but the Lord. He wants to be true to the one true God. And that's his way of expressing it. Now there is a weakness, I guess you might call it. Although I think Naaman is looking ahead. And I think this is another evidence of his conversion. He's looking ahead and he's knowing what's going to happen when he gets back home. He says, in this matter, may the Lord pardon your servant. So he's asking for forgiveness already for something that he knows is not going to be appropriate. He says, when my master goes into the house of Rimmon, which is the god of Aram, to worship there. And so he's talking about when the king goes to this temple of this false god and goes to worship, and he drags Naaman along with him, and he leans on me. In other words, he literally pulls me down that I should bow down to Rimmon. May the Lord pardon your servant in this matter. He already sees that there's going to be a conflict in his life. And we can look at this and we can say, well, this is a weakness. He should go back and he should stand up and he should, you know, he should sacrifice his life, you know, and make his faith in God known and not give in. Well, maybe that's true and maybe someday he will. But today, he's not going to do that. He's not there yet. And there are many of us today that aren't there yet. You know, how many times can we raise our hands along with Peter and say, I don't know him. I don't know that Jesus. I don't know what you're talking about. We've all been there, haven't we? At least this man was willing to admit that he could see down the road that that was going to be a problem. So I believe, yes, Naaman definitely was converted. And so Elisha says to him, go in peace. So he departed from him some distance. So we've gotten through six characters and we've seen a dramatic change in the man Naaman. And if you notice, there's a pivotal character. There's Elisha. There's the two kings. They're kind of insignificant. There's the servants. Both of them having major impact on this. There's Naaman, who starts out an arrogant, full of himself man, changed to be a person who is willing to offer only sacrifices to the one true God. But Gehazi, the servant of Elisha, the man of God, thought, behold, my master has spared this Naaman, the Aramean, by not receiving from his hand what he brought. As the Lord lives, I will run after him and take something from him. We already see in this one verse, we get a peek, a glimpse into the character of Gehazi. My master has spared this Naaman. This Naaman is a Gentile. What right does he have to come to Israel and receive the blessings that we of Israel ought to receive? And then he doesn't even require anything of him. He's let him off way too easy. This is wrong. This shouldn't be. So I'm going to fix it. I'm going to go after him. So Gehazi pursues Naaman. When Naaman saw one running after him, he came down from the chariot to meet him and said, "Is all well?" A little side note right here. What did Naaman do when Gehazi approached? A man of Naaman's stature would never dismount his chariot to a servant. But yet, the converted Naaman does. His heart's been changed. His attitude's been changed. He is a changed man. And we see that in his response to Gehazi. But what about Gehazi? Is all well? He said, all is well. My master has sent me, saying, behold, just now two young men from the sons of the prophets have come to me from the hill country of Ephraim. Please give them a talent of silver and two changes of clothes. What a liar. Here is a guy who is supposed to be the servant of probably one of the greatest prophets in all of Israel, and he has to stoop to lying. Now, lest we be really hard on Gehazi, he asked for a talent of gold or a talent of silver. And you might be wondering, well, what's a talent? How much is a talent of silver? Well, back in 1 Kings chapter 16, verse 24, it says he, and it's referring to a king, but it says he bought the hill Samaria from Shimer for 2 talents of silver. So that gives you an idea of what the value of a talent of silver is. It'll buy you a half a hill. And so Gehazi, seeing all of this wealth just there for the taking, is succumbing to the temptation to trade the blessing of God for material wealth. Naaman doesn't know any better. And so what does Naaman do? He says, be pleased to take 2 talents of silver. So now Gehazi can buy the whole hill. And he urged him and bound 2 talents of silver in 2 bags and 2 changes of clothes and gave them to the 2 servants, and they carried them before him. When he came to the hill, he took them from their hand and deposited them in the house, and he sent the men away and they departed. I think basically what this is trying to do is give us a sense of the stealth of Gehazi in trying to hide what he's doing. Apparently there was a rise or a hill on the road as you came into to Jerusalem. And so he took the stuff from the men before he got over the hill because he didn't want to be seen by the people of the city, and especially not by Elisha. And he told them, you know, okay, go, I can take it from here. And then he goes and he hides the stuff in the house. And then he went in and stood before his master. And Elisha said to him, where you been, Gehazi? And he said, your servant went nowhere. Let me explain something, especially to you young people, about lying. When you lie, your memory has to be impeccable, because you got to remember who you lied to and who you didn't lie to. You got to remember what you lied and what you didn't lie. See, if you always tell the truth, there's no question, because you only got to remember one thing. But when you lie, you got to have a great memory. So once you start lying, it just keeps going. And it did for Gehazi. I went nowhere. Then he said to him, did not my heart go with you when the man turned from his chariot to meet you? We can contrast Naaman to Gehazi here. Naaman, a man of prestige, of position, of wealth, is confronted by God and converted and becomes humble and contrite. And Gehazi, who has every opportunity, he is of the house of Israel. He is with the prophet. He's watched these things, these other miracles occur. He watched Naaman be healed. Given all of the opportunity to do the right thing, and yet, in and of himself, he is a slave to sin. He can only do what he can do. And Elisha says, is it time to receive money, to receive clothes? olive gardens, vineyards, sheep, oxen, male and female servants. When did Gehazi get these things? It can only be assumed that, you know, maybe Elisha had insight into the hopes and dreams of Gehazi. Maybe Gehazi had expressed this at some point. But it was obvious that Gehazi's desire was not to be a prophet of Israel, but it was to be someone who owned a lot of stuff. Stuff was more important to Gehazi than being true to God. And so therefore, as a sign of his condition, Elisha says, "Therefore the leprosy of Naaman shall cling to you and your descendants forever." And he went out from his presence, a leper as white as snow. There's consequences. When we turn our back on God, we receive the fruits of our own desires. You know, maybe Gehazi got his vineyards and his olive groves and his sheep and his oxen. But there's never another mention of him in the Bible. We don't know what happened to him. Chances are he died a bitter, anguishing death because of the decision not to be true to God. And so today, we've gone through a lot. We've seen a lot of different characters. We've seen people who have no stature, no position, have great impact in other people's lives. We've seen the sovereignty of God working to bring a young girl away from her family into a place where she could tell of God's great ability to heal. We've seen the conversion of a Gentile. Unheard of. We've seen a son of Israel so consumed with his greed. That he probably wishes he was dead. We see the man of God simply being there, simply doing what God has commanded him to do, not taking credit for it, not using it for gain. And we've seen two kings who think the world revolves around them and yet they were powerless to do anything. Which one of these characters do we identify with this morning? Which one do we want to be identified with? Which one characterizes our life? I challenge you this morning to look at your life. Are you a Naaman? Are you a Gehazi? Are you a servant girl? Are you a king? Are you a prophet? Where does God have you today? And are you willing to be what God has called you to be and where He's called you to be?